Hi, everybody. Wow. Another week, another full week. That's pretty pretty amazing. Welcome to Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa, where we examine one of the best known and I think, I hope I've shown you least known and least understood tractates in the Mishnah, otherwise known as Ethics of Fathers. The our half-hour meetings are brought to you by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue, under the leadership of Rabbi Ariel Constantine. For those of you who are members of the synagogue or who live in Tel Aviv, I am happy to announce that this coming Shabbat, Parshat Lech Lecha, good for everybody, all of you Olim who are members of the community, I will be substituting for Rabbi Constantine in the synagogue. So please feel, you're always welcome, but please do come by on Friday night or Shabbat in the morning or in the afternoon. Say hi, participate. If you have questions you didn't want to put online to me or other issues, please come by, introduce yourselves. The last time I was at the shul, it was really a pleasure to turn virtual students and friends into real students and friends, I'd like to grow that community. So please do come by. That's this coming Shabbat. Okay, we are finally finishing the Mishnah, the fifth Mishnah in the second parak of second chapter of Pirkei Avot which contains a series of maybe connected, perhaps non-connected, disconnected statements by the first century BCE and the first century CE sage Hillel. It sort of ends with a bang. The last statement that Hillel makes is "B'makom she'ein anashim hishtadel lihiyot ish." Where there are no other men, try to be a man. Now, we are not talking about, this is not gender specific. This is not you should only be a man. Women don't count. This is a sort of a generic thing. There's nothing you can do about it. The Hebrew language, when it takes in both genders, uses the male. I don't think it's a statement of gender discrimination. Well, what's the point? What's interesting here, it seems to be self-evident. But if nobody else is willing to take up the responsibility, you do it. Strikingly, this is another one of these, so self-evident. So because the meaning is self-evident, don't be a wallflower, I mean, whatever, however you want to look at it, because the meaning is self-evident, that leads among the commentaries and those who cited this line, a tremendous amount leeway for subsequent writers to see this line as a mirror. In other words, to bring their own concerns to the understanding of the words and to say things which are of concern to them in their particular times. In addition, and we're going to get to a few serious examples in a bit. In addition, we're going to find that this line actually, "B'makom she'ein anashim hishtadel lihiyot ish," became something of a very popular, not slogan, what's what I'm looking for. Proverb or adage. Okay. So, for example, it even penetrated penetrated Yiddish. So we can explain it the way we want. But I remember my late father-in-law used to quote a Yiddish adage that he knew where he had learned as a kid, and the adage went, "B'makom she'einish is a herring oichafish," in a place where there's no people, even a herring is a fish. Now, one could argue that. Okay, that seems a little odd. What kind of statement is that? So, strikingly, especially for Eastern European Jews who, and Dutch Jews, I have to put the Dutch Jews in because the Dutch Jews also like herring, Eastern European Jews, herring is a delicacy. And did anybody doubt that a herring is a fish? I really never understood the statement until, I guess about 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I happened to be in Rome, and I took a break to sign up for a tour of the ghetto under the aegis of Jewish Rome, which is led by my friend Michaela Papancello. And if you are in Rome, please don't, if you need a wonderful, or you're looking for a wonderful tour of Rome from a Jewish perspective, contact Michaela. Anyways, so we took this trip, my wife and I took this tour of Rome and the ghetto. The ghetto is at the end of at the edge of the ghetto is what used to be the fish market. Portico d'Ottavia. It was an area that was actually built by Augustus in honor of his sister. In any event, no, I'm sorry, not in honor of his sister. In honor of his sister. In any event, the guide, whose unfortunately name I don't remember, mentioned that Jews who lived in the ghetto, despite the fact that the ghetto was right next to the fish market, were not allowed to come and buy fish until the end of the day, at which point the best catches, the best types, were not available. What all that was left for Jews to buy was a smaller fish, which is herring, or sardines, or anchovies, you know, little fish that nobody else wanted. So the guide mentioned that this sort of like was a boomerang for the Roman authorities, because as we all know, those fish have more omega-3 than anything else, so that helped to advance Jewish intellect. The point is, however, that in the popular contention, the popular imagination, herring is a less valuable fish. So then I understood what the point of my father-in-law's statement was, and that is that b'makom she'ein ish is the herring or fish, that when nobody else is around, even the person who sees himself or maybe is objectively not as talented is the one who was asked to step up. And that is exactly what we're going to discuss. But we have to see it, you can look at it from different points of view. So let's go through a few different possibilities and see where they take us. So I did a search as to what the as to how different writers had understood this statement. So there is a late 11th, early 12th century commentary that's printed in the standard editions of the Talmud, which is attributed to Rashi. Rashi did not write it. It comes out of the same kind of milieu. It apparently is a German commentary. It comes from the Rhineland. When I saw it, my eyes actually really sort of bugged out, because the author says, "B'makom she'ein ish, she'ein anashim hishtadel lihiyot ish." If there are ish, meaning what you would call in French an homme d'affaires, a business person or a person of the affairs of this world, he says, if there is no one willing to take upon themselves the responsibilities of public welfare, then by all means you should absolutely make the effort and try to do so. However, if there is no one else, or if there are others who can do it, you go back to yeshiva and study. In other words, what you have here, and this is very striking, because what you have here is an explicit disinclination on the part of the author to promote the involvement of scholars in public life. Sort of a more, I would even say a more monastic kind of attitude that the place of the person who's the Talmid Chacham, of the scholar, should be in the library, should be in the Beit Midrash, studying and not wasting their time on public affairs, on politics. That's now that there is such an approach, such an ideal doesn't apply, but it really struck me as odd in terms of the kind of early Ashkenazic kind of life or kind of milieu in which from which this commentary comes, because specifically at the time of Rashi, again, this is not Rashi, but it comes from his world, it was assumed that the rabbis were part of the general community. On the contrary, the leaders of the community and the rabbinic elite were either came from the same classes and the same family, or they were the same people. Rabbis didn't take money for being a rabbi. They were merchants, or they did whatever they did to make a living. So they were, by definition, they were force outside in the world. So then the question becomes, so what are we talking about? So this is a very odd statement, and it sort of like shows that even in a community which was so sort of like in both worlds, you had voices that were saying, no, this is a concession. Being involved in public life is a concession. Now, there's no question, we talked about this, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, when we discussed the question of how much should you work your business if you actually want to also become a scholar and you want to be wise and you want to worship God properly. That tension is built in. I mean, so that part I understand. But this idea that if you can at all avoid public life and giving to the community, that would be the better way to go, unless you're absolutely forced to, because nobody else was willing to do it, that I found to be very sobering. I had an instant reaction to it, and I think it's wrong. I think that even unless you're really not qualified to do anything except to study and teach. I think there's something extremely selfish about not giving to the broader community. Yes, it's true, politics and communal life is consuming, but it is no less valid for that. It's another way of looking. In fact, if you want to know the truth, I think it also violates the overall tenor, the overall timbre of this passage by Hillel, because don't forget, Hillel starts here by saying, Al tifrosh ma tzibur, don't abandon the community. Now, we've discussed all kinds of different ways of looking at that, but one of the implications and one of the ways of looking at that line of not abandoning the community or separating yourself from the community is, don't sit there and lock yourself in a room and not give back. But nevertheless, this is anonymous persons, apparently, at least I don't know who wrote the commentary. If there's somebody else, I can double check to see who, if it's been attributed to anyone. But that's one way of looking at it. Okay. Another more obvious, I think, way of interpreting the line is attributed to I guess not just attributed, is enunciated by Rabbi Avadya Sforno. Now, Rabbi Avadya Sforno is an interesting person. He was a 15th century, early 16th century doctor and philosopher and rabbi and biblical commentator. And the interesting thing about Rabbi Avadya Sforno was that, first of all, he's one of the first people to have graduated from the University of Bologna medical faculty. That was not something that was normal. Jews who became doctors generally did it in a fashion which we would usually call like apprenticeship. You'd find a Jewish doctor, the doctor would train you, and then he would say, when you're ready to go, he'll let you be a doctor. But going to medical school was not something which Jews were allowed to do. And it's interestingly, many Jewish historians saw in his acceptance to the Bologna Medical School, which is still a very fine medical school and still attracts a lot of Jews, especially Israelis who can't get into it because there are so few places in Israeli medical schools. Sforno, they see in this acceptance sort of like a sign of the, wonderful relations that obtained between Jews and Christians in Renaissance Italy, that all of the hostility and we find in elsewhere Christian Europe didn't obtain. That's baloney. There is a book which I highly recommend. It's in Italian, though. Oh, here it is, sitting next to my thing. A book by a great scholar whose name was Vittorio Colorni. He died a number of years ago. There's the book. The book is called Judaica Minora. In that book, Colorni has an article in which he shows, in which he has the a copy of Obadiah Sforno's diploma from medical school. And if you read the diploma, I'm not going to depress you totally in terms of the way it's written, but let's say that it's the way that this diploma is written. It's not a standard text the way that most diplomas are. It's basically the faculty says, well, we let him in and we hoped he would convert to Christianity, but he didn't, but he finished school, so he'll make him a doctor. This is not a, this is not like a great endorsement of Jewish Christian relations. Anyways. Sforno was an interesting person. He, as long as we're talking about him, he actually wrote, simultaneously published in Latin and in, Hebrew, his great philosophical work, which is called Or Amim, The Light of the Nations, which he published in Latin at the same time, Lux Gentium, the same thing, or The Light of the Nations. But he's best known, as I said, for his commentary on Chumash and elsewhere, and says the Sforno as follows on our Mishnah. B'makom she'ena nashim, yishtodel liyot ish. He says, you know, we have a tendency to get full of ourselves. And we are, and I think it's something that we're all involved with. We have a tendency, if we have an insight, if we have an idea, to get all excited. And to have, how did somebody put it to me next, in general, in the media age, we have a tendency to have our fingers are light on the send button, whether it's to post in Facebook, to send in Twitter, or to send a mail. Now, I know when I was a business person, I had a travel company, I know that for a while, I lost actually an investor because I sent off a letter without realizing that a previous correspondence, which I didn't want him to see, was at the bottom of the thing, and that was into that. So anyways, he says, you know, what does that mean? He says that if you have achieved something, if you've made a discovery with a novel Torah interpretation, you have a great idea, whatever, breathe deeply, and don't rush publishing. Don't rush to publish so fast. If there are those who are greater than you, raise the issue, discuss it, bring it to those who know more than you, be aware of those who know more than you, and then after you've fully developed and sort of seasoned the idea, then there's no problem in terms of publishing. Okay. But don't be so quick to run into print before, you know, you've really talked it over with others that are greater and smarter than you. And there are always those who are greater and smarter than you. The sign of, you know, it's funny, the sign of the fine scholar, of the great scholar, is the one who has lots of people in their acknowledgments in terms of when they write their introduction to their books, because they know what they don't know, and therefore they're going to check with other people who might be able to give them other ideas, and then they go forward. However, says Sforno, if you're living in an era of intellectual pygmies, or there really is no one else around, don't sit there and overly restrict yourself. On the contrary, you have an obligation, even if you think you don't measure up to others who might be greater than you, who perhaps lived at another time, that should not paralyze you. You are of an obligation to express your ideas, to spread your ideas, to stand up, and to be counted to the degree that you can. One of the great, there's a wonderful, Ecclesiastes has a line in which he says that, don't sit there and say, the people lived before me were greater, so I have no right to an opinion. You're what there is. You're all there is. If that's all there is, then you've got to be it. Now, Sfarno says it in the context of Torah study. I've expanded it to the area of scholarship and so on. However, the truth of the matter is, it's really, 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 it's really, really applies to everything else in life. So, for example, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, who was a Rav in the early 15th century in Fez, says, you know what? When there is a need, you got to stand up. You got to step up to the plate. You don't have a choice. Not hishtadel. Hishtadel liotish doesn't mean I'll try. I don't know. Maybe no. No. You have to be determined. You have to be determined, and you have to be firm, and you have to know that this is what I'm supposed to do, even though it's hard, even though it's not what I'm, even though it's not what I had in mind doing for the rest of my life, and even if it was a matter of. You're going to pay a price. Hishtadel means you have to constantly work on yourself to have the inner fortitude to do what's right. Doing what's right is the highest is the prime directive. And hence, so even if it takes you out of your writer's garret, even if it takes you out of your comfort zone, on the contrary. The function of a person is to leave their comfort zone. There is a finally, I mean, we could go on forever like this. By the way, you know, there's a wonderful, unfortunately it's not translated to Hebrew. And it's in Hebrew, so translated in English. A colleague of mine, Professor Avigdor Shenon, has been engaged in an incredible project, which has been sponsored by Beit Avichai for many, many years, in which he's been writing what he calls contemporary Israeli commentary on. So this contemporary Israeli commentary on all kinds of books of the Bible, Ruth and Esther. I think he's got Lamentations. I believe he just wrote on Ecclesiastes, on Kohelet, and he has a commentary on Pirkei Avot as well. Now, the commentary on Pirkei Avot is online for those of you who know Hebrew and can't get the book. It's online at the Sefaria website, Sefaria website.org. And he says, you know, what should be the obvious? What better example do we have of people, it's not just Jews, of people who did the right thing when no one else was willing than Chassidei Umot HaOlam, than those who, people during the war, during World War II, put their lives and the lives of their families at risk in order to save Jews who were being threatened with death by the Nazis, because it was the right thing to do. Doing the right thing is the prime directive. Finally, there's an obvious twist, Yiddish twist. We started with herring, so we'll, at least in Europe, we'll end with this. Literally means what we've said, but an ish in Yiddish is a mensch, and a mensch in Yiddish, for those of you who don't know, is a person who acts like a human being. He is polite, or she is respectful, is dignified, acts in a way which is not reprehensible, doesn't use profanity, doesn't make ad hominem arguments, doesn't belittle or dehumanize anybody else. You act like a mensch, like a person. With dignity, and you respect somebody else's dignity, treating everybody in the world
as my friend Rabbi Dr. Moshe Berger from Cleveland says, always remembering that the person standing in front of you was also created in the image of God. One of the, I think I mentioned this, I mentioned this in my Parsha video a couple of weeks ago, that Rabbi Naftali Zvi Yehuda Berlin, in a famous introduction to his commentary on the Bible, on the Torah rather, called HaMegdavar, says that the whole function of the book of Genesis is to teach people how to get along with each other and to deal with one another respectfully, because kad derech eretz kadma l'torah, because how to be a person, how to be a mensch, hishtadel liyot me'ish, is the free. Without that, the Torah can't get off the ground. Hence, hishtadel liyot me'ish means if everybody's acting in an untoward and disgusting and impolite and disrespectful manner, it's easy to get carried away with that. It's incredibly easy to go with the mob and sit there and be part of a Twitter mob and a cancellation mob and whatever mob you want to have or don't want to have. Hishtadel liyot ish. Work on yourself to make sure that what you become and the way that you act is like an ish. It's like a mensch. It's a ben adam created in the image of God who is aware of the fact that everybody else is similarly created. So, we will see you next time. Those of you in Tel Aviv, you are welcome to come, please, this coming Shabbat to the Tel Aviv International Synagogue, number one. Number two, please feel free to share this video to whomever. It'll be not only on my Facebook page and on the Tel Aviv International Synagogue Facebook page. It'll be on my YouTube channel, which you are welcome to, please, to... subscribe to. There will be a audio version on YU Torah, and please get the word around. Let's and please, I welcome your answers, your questions. You can contact me on Facebook. You can do the comments down here, or you can send me a direct message. Whatever is easiest for you. We will see you next time.